This week in cycling history.
Hello everyone and welcome to This Week in Cycling History. Coming up on today's Tango through the tumbleweeds of two-wheeled adventures gone by is Charlie Motti at the Giro di Lombardia, and then on to the thorny and existential question of why bike races exist at all. However, before we get to all that, please be upstanding and welcome the one and only Killian Kelly.
Hello Scott, thank you for stepping in and thanks for having me.
Not at all. It's good to talk, as ever, although it is getting increasingly far and few between the times that we managed to get together and speak, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Skype reliably informed me there that it was over a year since we last did this together. So, yeah, it's been a while.
It has been. Right, let's move quickly on then to our first topic of today's show. As I mentioned in the intro there, it's on Charlie Motti.
Like most races, the Tour of Lombardy has had some periods in its history when it has been won by a series of riders who are most famous now for having shone brightly and briefly and then tested positive for some drug or other. Most of the time, this period in any given race's history is during the 1990s and 2000s. For the Tour of Lombardy, the list of those winners includes the likes of Oscar Cammansand, Raimondus Rumzas and Danilo De Luca. But unlike most races, the Tour of Lombardy can claim to have gone through a brief period where it was won by a couple of riders who were not known for doping. Quite the opposite, in fact. These riders were known for being completely clean. In an era of the sport where taking drugs was a much easier decision than it is now, because the chances of getting caught were practically zero, these riders took the high road and refused to bow to the pressure and the acceptance that doping was just what you had to do. One such rider was Charlie Motti, who won the Tour of Lombardy 30 years ago this year in a marauding solo victory, which was one of the most impressive rides ever seen by a French rider in the race of the falling leaves. Peter Cossens describes the race and Motti himself in his book The Monuments, The Grit and Glory of Cycling's Greatest One-Day Races. Among the most heroic of successes was Charlie Motti's tremendous solo victory in 1988. The Frenchman, best known for his three Dauphiné Libre wins and subsequent role as route director on that race, was not only one of the most talented riders of his generation, but also had a spotless reputation. In his book Breaking the Chain, Willy Vaughy, the soigneur from the Festina team who was arrested in 1998 after industrial quantities of doping products were found in the team car he was driving to the start of the Tour de France, said of the Frenchman's arrival at the RMO team in 1989, "Charlie Motti helped to clean up the team. He was the team leader, he had more influence than anyone on the way his teammates thought, and he never wanted to know about drugs. It was only as the races went by and we ate with him and spent time with him that we worked out what kind of a fellow we were dealing with. This was one clean cyclist. You could honestly say that Motti was a victim of drug-taking right through his career, of other riders' drug-taking. If he had used some stuff to help him recover, perhaps only now and then, the list of races which he won, already a long one, would have been considerably longer. Small, powerfully built, and with a thick fuzz of blonde hair, Motti was a strong all-rounder with a particular penchant for long time trials. A three-time winner of the Grand Prix de Nation, which for decades was the unofficial time trial championship of the world, he wasn't among the principal Lombardy favourites in 1988, but looked strong as he bridged up to world champion Maurizio Fondriest on the Valcava climb. With him was Luke Rousin. When the Belgian punctured on the descent and Fondriest fell back, Motti persisted with his effort, climbing the Valpiana, which at 1,000 metres was the perfect height for a rider who struggled on longer passes. Motti pushed his lead out to more than 3 minutes. Commentating on Italian TV, old rivals Giuseppe Soroni and Francesco Moser were astounded by what they were witnessing. The latter admitted the only comparison he could make was with the stories that his older brother Aldo used to tell him about watching Fausto Coppi during his best years. Motti's raid was, declared Moser, comparable to Il Campionissimo in his pump. Motti won by almost 2 minutes and came close to a second victory 2 years later, finishing third when compatriot Gilles Deligny proved quickest of a five-man group that included Scott Robert Miller.
Now, your first note from that piece, Killian, is what it meant not to take drugs in an era where basically everyone, it would seem, was doping in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, I think it's always useful to remind yourself of the differences between Cycling Today and back in the this particular edition of the Tour of Lombardy was in the 80s, but you know, bleeding Mate's career bled into the 90s as well, and that was obviously the start of EPO as we came to know it, and the whole problem that brought with it. And you know, every now and again you hear people trot out these phrases like, we're in the cleanest era that we've ever been in for cycling, and it's never been cleaner, and it's very easy to kind of roll your eyes at when you hear those sorts of phrases and think, oh yeah, you know, we've heard all that before, and we have heard all that before, but I think there are notable differences now between now and back then, 20, 25 years ago. You know, it's okay now for riders to say that they're not happy with one doping story or another. Now, that's not to say that they all do it. They don't, but some of them do. And, you know, saying something like that would have been inconceivable in Charlie Mate's day. And, you know, what it meant in that day not to take drugs is so much different than what it is now. And that, you know, that's kind of course it is, like, it's an obvious point to make, but it is always worth remembering just how difficult it was for guys back then. And the fact that you can probably name all of the guys who we know were clean back then on I don't know, maybe the fingers of two hands, you could do it. It just shows you how few of them there were. It stands out to me when I read stories about these guys, the kind of the moral courage that they must have had to do this, just because it was just so normal. Drugs were just taken and there was no tests. There was no moral obligation not to do it. The UCI didn't really care. And yet you still had guys who wanted to forge a professional career, a good one, and not succumb to those temptations, even though there was literally no reason not to, other than their own conscience.
You know, it's kind of weird when you think about it in those terms of the guys that have the courage to stand up and go, no, actually, genuinely, I'm not on the sauce. If you read the book that Richard Moore did on Robert Miller back in the day, it's like almost a similar reaction to the riders around him because he was vegetarian. It's like, what? Like, you've just fallen from space. You only eat vegetables. Similar thing. What, you don't dope? This is weird.
Yeah, just incredulous reactions all around. I'm reminded as well of a story in Paul Kimmage's book, Rough Ride, when he turned up to what would have been one of his first professional races when he was in France, and he had this little box with him, a little kind of briefcase, and, you know, he brought it up to his hotel room and he was taking it in front of his roommate, and his roommate just assumed that it was his box full of needles and drugs and potions and whatever else, whereas actually it was kind of writing materials, you know, pens and stationery for writing letters home, and he was laughed at, and you know what are you doing, you know, this is the done thing, and you need to get on the program or get on the case, because, you know, you're going to be laughed out of the sport. And a lot of these guys were, which is the sad thing. The other rider, I think I mentioned in the piece that there was two guys who were renowned for being clean in an era when almost everybody wasn't. And the other rider was another French rider called Gilles Deslion, who enjoyed a very similar reputation. Well, I say enjoyed, maybe enjoys now. Endured,
yeah, is probably the better word.
Yeah, exactly, to that of Charlie Mate. And between the pair of them, you know, they kind of fly this flag for clean riding in that era. And but the reason I mentioned Deslion as well isn't just for doping reasons. He played a part in the Tour of Lombardy too. He is the second guy in that kind of little mini spell of clean winners that the Tour of Lombardy had in this time. And it just struck me that it was quite unusual that two of these guys should actually win one of the biggest, hardest, most toughly fought races on the calendar, that they both managed it. And I was struck as well by just a little anecdote. It was in Peter Costens' book as well, actually, just below the extract that I took out, just about Mate's win. 2 years later, Gilles Dillion did it as well. And he was in a move at the front of the race. There was three of them. And one of them was Gilles Dillion's teammate, Pascal Richard. He was a Swiss rider. And the other was Charlie Motte. And the team leader of the team that Dillion and Pascal Richard were on was being managed by Paul Cuckley, who, if people remember that name, he was the kind of tactical mastermind behind a lot of what Bernardino did in the 1980s. And he plays a big role in another Richard Moore book, Slaying the Badger, where about the 1986 tour where Bernardino plays psychological havoc on Greg LeMond. And a lot of that stems from Paul Cuckley being in charge. And anyway, he was the director sportif of Pascal Richard and Gilles Dillion in this race. And he kind of basically said to them, his tactical advice at this race was, I'll leave it up to you. Who's ever in the better position to attack and take the win, do it. So he kind of pitted them against each other, was his way of handling this situation. And sure enough, a few kilometers to go, Pascal Richard attacked and got a gap and looked like that was that. All the breakaway were looking at each other, and you know, it was one of those moves where you kind of get the feeling, yeah, that's it. He's made it. And it was only kind of coming into the last kilometer, last couple of kilometers, that it was Charlie Motte who decided that, no, I'm not going to let this guy win, and I'm going to be the sacrificial lamb. Obviously, whoever was going to chase him down was not going to, or probably not, almost certainly not going to end up winning the race. But he did it anyway. And Gilles Dillion was kind of theorizing after the race. He did catch him, and eventually Dillion nipped past to win, beating Motte, but also his own teammate, Pascal Richard, to the win. And Dillion, years later, was theorizing about this. And he said he never spoke to Charlie Motte about it, but he likes to think, and he thinks the reason for it was that Motte decided to chase Pascal Richard down because Richard had spent the last 60 kilometers out front in the breakaway, not contributing anything. And Motte just didn't want a guy like that, having raced like that, to win. And he was willing to completely sacrifice his own chances of winning the Tour Lombardy again, just to see Pascal Richard not winning. And on the one hand, you might think that that's quite, you know, a spiteful thing to do, but on another, you might think it maybe adds to the kind of towering conscience that it seems Charlie Motte has. And he did it for the kind of the purity of the sport, or the purity of racing, that Pascal Richard didn't deserve to win. So those are two guys that did, for all we're told, and for all other riders would tell you. And at the end of the day, that's the biggest telling. It's the biggest tell that guys are clean, is when you have dopers willing to say, actually, we were all doing it, but those guys didn't do it. And that's the case with these two. And yeah, it's just strange that both of them ended up winning the Tour of Lombardy back then.
And I think maybe one of the other markers of whether someone was worth listening to or not was whether Hein Verbruggen actually decried them in some way, shape or form.
Yes, and that was certainly the case with, if not Charlie Motte, it was certainly the case with Gilles Dillion. And this was a little bit later on. I think this was 1997, so it was actually before Festina, so it was still really taboo to talk about this stuff. Kimmich had been beating the drum for 6 or 7 years at that point. But in 1997, Gilles Dillion was kind of being asked questions about this as well. And I'm not certain what he said. I haven't tracked down exactly what he said to the media during this time, but you know, I presume it was along the same lines, that you know, everybody was at it. And Hein Verbruggen himself, who was still UCI president at that time, he took it upon himself to respond, and he kind of said, you can't trust these guys, and they should be vilified for saying this about this sport. And he just, you know, again, Dillion probably thought he was doing the sport a favor of shedding light on what was going on, and he absolutely wasn't. And he was vilified by Verbruggen himself. And like you say, if Hein Verbruggen doesn't like what you're saying, you're probably saying something correct or right. So that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll probably look back, if not in the near future, then certainly now, at Hein Verbruggen and look at him with that sense of, why on earth did we ever listen to that? kind of like we do with Coldplay, you know, that kind of thing. But if we can move on to the Tour of Lombardy itself, as you were kind of saying, or as Petter Cousins had been alluding to, the race kind of lost its way in the 90s and the noughties, and didn't really have the feel of a monument classic, whereas we definitely regard it as such now. And I guess the question, if you can answer it, would be, what do you think caused that? You know, what caused it to have such a poor reputation across those two decades?
Yeah, well, first of all, just the idea of it being a monument classic in the first place, which is like so many things in cycling. I kind of everything, I think, in cycling. If you were to sit down and design it now, you wouldn't design it the way it's done now. So it's quite peculiar that you have this collection of five races, four of which appear within a month of each other. And, you know, then you have the Tour of Lombardy in October, which is, it's senseless. Yeah, like so much of the sport, it just does not make any sense. So from that point of view, I'm not really sure how it got lumped together in this collection of five. I remember when we did the book show with Petter Cousins all those years ago, at this stage, it must be maybe 3 or 4 years ago, he wrote that book, The Monuments, and we spoke to him at the time, and I said, I asked him this question, why these five races? And the short answer is he didn't know. As far as I can figure out, nobody really knows how this happened. But, you know, it's happened, and they did get lumped together. And they were a set of five. I'm not quite sure when that happened, when it became a set of five. But I think it's almost certainly true that it was the case in the 80s. And so... Yeah, so your question is why did it kind of lose its way? I think maybe it's a combination of a couple of things where right up until 1989, the World Cup stopped. So this was the collection of races that made up of one day races, which made up the World Cup, which wasn't just these five Monument Classic. It was another few races. It was Flèche Wallonne, the Wincanton Classic was in it a couple of times. There was about 10 altogether, Amstel Gold, about 10 or 12 races, depending on the year. And that ended in 1989 in favor of kind of a more global system where you just figure out who's the best rider rather than who's the best rider altogether in every race rather than just a sub collection of races. So that ended. And I'd say that had an effect where riders would have stretched their seasons to include the Tour of Lombardy on purpose so that they could get points towards this World Cup, which was prestigious back then. And they just didn't bother anymore because they didn't have an incentive to stay fit. And there was no kind of late season focal point for the year. As soon as the World Championships was over, which was actually a little bit earlier back then as well, it was much more close to the Tour de France in August, that people's seasons would just fizzle out. And so I think that maybe played a part in it. There was also on the other end of that, maybe 10, 15 years, which I think Petter Cousins is alluding to, that 10 or 15 years, maybe between 1990 and 2005. 2005 was the start of the Pro Tour, the World Tour as we know it now. And that forced the biggest teams, maybe not necessarily the biggest riders, but certainly the biggest teams to go to the Tour of Lombardy, whereas that wasn't the case before. And it became, if you look at the start lists of the race in those years, it became a little bit of a parochial affair, as were all races, really. I remember speaking to John before about the Vuelta España of 2004, which would have been the last one before the Pro Tour and before these mandatory invites were extended to the top 18 or 19 teams or whatever it is. And the top, I think I'm right in saying that out of the top 25 riders on GC at the end of the 2004 Tour of Spain, only two of them weren't Spanish. That kind of gives you a sense of how parochial these races had become. And the Tour of Lombardy, I don't think it was quite that, quite as Italian as the Vuelta had become Spanish, but it wasn't far off. But in 2005, kind of forced all of the big teams to take part again, and you just got a higher quality field. I mean, I'm kind of guessing because I wasn't really watching the Tour of Lombardy in those years. But I do think even since I have started watching it, which is kind of since I kind of returned to the sport after a hiatus in 2008, that even in those 10 years since 2008, I think it's become more interesting. Like even the first few years where I watched it, Damiano Cunego won it the first time, and then Philippe Gilbert won it the two times after. And it seemed a little bit of a procession. Now, that can happen in any race, depending on who the protagonists are and who's fit and who's motivated. But it didn't really have the feel of a monument classic. I don't really know what tangible feelings those are, but it just didn't really grip you. It didn't. It could have been any of one of those, you know, the Italian races that we've been treated to on television over the last couple of weeks. Could have been any one of those. It didn't really feel any different. And just slowly over the years, I think it has started to feel different. I don't know if that's me or if it's the race itself, but I haven't done a kind of an analysis of the quality of the field, but it does seem like it's increasing and riders are treating it more seriously and treating it as a focal point of the second half of the season. So yeah, I think just for those two reasons, one, the end of the World Cup, and two, the start of the Pro Tour, is maybe why there was those kind of wilderness years, as Peter Costens describes them.
I can sense that there was a you know, a clear dividing line before and after, or it must be about 2011, 2012, I think it's 2011, where they completely renovated the course.
Yeah.
And we're going back to Charlie Motti. You kind of said in your notes, he's one of those riders that by the time you were aware of him, he was a shadow of his former self, and you have this picture of him of never being a great rider, never being able to win races with aplomb.
Yeah, it's just I'm sure everybody's the same whenever they started watching the sport. But for me, it was the early 90s, and there was all just this particular set of riders who were maybe the wrong side of 30, and who I had firsthand experience of watching. You know, it wasn't like Merckx or Coppi, or I never got to watch those guys while they were racing, so I had to you're forced to kind of go back and learn about them. And of course, when you start going back to learn about them, they're immediately legends. That's all you can read about them, is how great they were. Whereas when you're watching these guys firsthand, you can make your own mind up when you're watching them in the Tour de France. And yeah, sure, I think I might have mentioned this to John and in one of the last shows that we said this, the same was actually true, and you're not going to like this, was true for me with Fignon. I know how much of a fan of Fignon you are.
I'm going to come over there and slap your ass in the middle of next week for that comment.
But for me, Miguel Indurain wears the yellow jersey, Gianni Bugno wears the rainbow jersey, and at that time Fignon was just a domestique for Bugno on Gatorade. And that's who he was at that time. And of course, I went back and eventually learned who he really was. But the same was true of Charlie Motti. He was on a kind of a weird team called Novomoy, and for me that was the team of Wilfred Nelissen. He was a kind of flash in the pan Belgian sprinter who put it up to Mario Cipollini in the 1993 Tour de France. He wore the yellow jersey briefly that race, and Charlie Motti was just a jobbing domestique, and that is what he was at that stage in his career. He was nearly retired at that point, and so it's not as immediately obvious when you start kind of reading about these guys separate to your own experiences of them, actually how good they were, because you do have this embedded opinion of them that you've formed yourself and that hasn't been kind of written for you. So he suffers from that in my memory, that he was kind of just a domestique. But of course he was way more than that. His particularly through the spectacles that we have now of being able to view his career, that he was clean when most others were not. And he won the Dauphiné Libre three times. I was about to say he nearly won the Giro. He didn't really. He finished second in 1990. That was the year Gianni Bugno kind of ran rampant and led the race from start to finish. But Motti finished second that year. And, he won three stages of the Tour de France. And he was, he was an excellent rider. But it's kind of funny. I have him in the same category as Fignon in my head, because they're the pair of them are famous for a very famous incident in the 1987 Tour de France, which ended up with Stephen Roach winning the Tour. And that was when Jean-Francois Bernard took the yellow jersey after the time trial stage to Mont Ventoux. And it looked like perhaps, you know, it looked like he was the strongest rider in the race at that after that stage, and it looked like he had all the weapons he needed and all the talent and form to go on and win that tour. But it was the very next day that he lost the yellow jersey, and it was because of the scheming, if you want to call it that, of Charlie Mate and Laurent Fignon. They were teammates at that time on System U, and they it was really for Mate rather than Fignon. I think Fignon was recovering from injury and wasn't really a feature overall in that race, even though he won that stage to Laplan, which is famous for Stephen Roach collapsing. I think maybe people misremember that as Pedro Delgado winning that stage, but it was actually Laurent Fignon won that stage. So he was good, but he wasn't as good as he needed to be to challenge overall. And kind of GC leadership duties for that team fell to Mate. But between the pair of them, they decided that they were going to do something at the feed zone the next day. They decided this was a perfect place to stage an attack, an ambush. And that's exactly what they did. And as it happened, right at that moment, I mean, attacking in the feed zone isn't great anyway, but right at that time, Jean-Francois Bernard had I'm not sure if it was a puncture or a mechanical, but he was kind of stuck at the side of the road while this ambush was occurring. And Delgado and Roach were part of it as well, whether they were in on it or not, or whether they were just reacting to it on the road. I know which one Stephen Roach would tell you. But either way, they ended up the road, all of them, with Bernard trailing behind. And you know, it's impossible to know what would have panned out, but it was certainly true that scuppered Jean-Francois Bernard's chances for the overall win that year, and it kind of fell to Roach to take the reins from there, and you know, he ended up winning the race. So that was kind of a famous moment involving Charlie Mate and Laurent Fignon.
And Bernard, of course, ending up in third place and not the potential tour winner that he might have been. Final point in this before we move on to our next topic. You say in the notes, you know, you do wonder if these guys, along with, for example, Christophe Basson, give France this reputation as being clean when other countries were not. But of course, we've got to then consider the Festina affair and Richard Veronque and Laurent Jalabert, etc., etc.
Yeah, it's always something that kind of confuses me and sparks me off going down different rabbit holes, kind of trying to remember exactly what happened, because I think France or the French riders collectively do have this reputation of being wronged by EPO or this doping era, and that they weren't, as a nationality of a collection of riders, they didn't dabble as much as others. And, you know, I still see that bandied about now, that's a theory or just a viewpoint that people have. And I don't know if that's correct to say that. And I do wonder, like you said, I mean, the identity of a lot of the guys who are painted with this reputation now of having never doped. I mean, we've just spoken about two of them, Gilles Deslandres, Charlie Mate. You mentioned Christophe Basson is certainly a third one. You know, as I said when we started speaking, there aren't that many of them, and a lot of them do seem to be French. And I do wonder if that maybe gives the wrong impression of what actually happened in those days. Because, and like you said, there's so many counter examples to that of French riders who, you know, did test positive every much as often as a Spanish guy or an Italian guy. And, you know, the Festina team, they were, I think they were officially from Andorra. They were registered, but they were basically a French team and full of French riders. And, you know, we kind of can't forget that. And you mentioned Richard Veronque and Laurent Jalabert. You could throw in Christophe Moreau and Luc Leblanc and Lauren Brochard, and all of these guys got wrapped up in doping scandals. So, you know, to say that the French are cleaner, I think it's maybe a little bit more nuanced than that. I mean, it is true that it was a crime in France when it wasn't in other countries. And perhaps that did make a difference, that, you know, these guys were obviously much more disincentivized to do it than your average Spaniard or Italian. That attitude kind of stems from the fact that French riders have maybe struggled to win the biggest races, most notably the Tour de France, but other races as well. You know, they don't win a lot of Monument Classics. Pino won the Tour of Lombardy this week, but other than Arnaud Démare, who won Milan-San Remo a couple of years ago, it's been kind of 20 years since Laurent Jalabert won the Tour of Lombardy that a French rider has been successful in these races. So they don't have great success in the big races and haven't for 20 years. And I do see that used as a reason, you know, that, oh yeah, French riders don't dope as much as the rest. But whenever somebody says that, I'm reminded by an article that Shane Stokes wrote. It was in the pages of Pro Cycling magazine. It was a profile of a rider called Mark Scanlon, who was an Irish rider who won the Junior World Road Race Championships in 1998, and he eventually got signed for AG2R Le Mondial, and or AG2R Provoyance, or whatever manifestation of the team was at that time. And he left the sport very early on. I can't quite remember what age he was when he retired, but he was asked in that interview about doping and was it a factor, and he kind of said yeah, but he also remembers when he was starting off on his first year on that team that, you know, he was really kind of green and really enthusiastic and he wanted to do everything right and he wanted to train really hard and impress the coaches, and just by being really enthusiastic and wanting to work hard, he was mocked by his teammates. And I think he particularly highlighted the French riders, that they just had this attitude, this lackadaisical attitude. And I always remember that when the other point gets made, that French riders have suffered because everybody else doped and they didn't. I always remember that. But I don't know, we could get drawn into kind of generalizations and stereotypes here, which maybe don't apply to everybody. But it's just something to keep in mind when anybody brings that up about French riders in the future.
On now to our second topic of the show, and for this one, it would seem Killian is channeling the existential spirit of Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir.
Why do bicycle races exist? It's for the love of it, the thrill of beating a rival, the triumph of crossing the line first, the adrenaline rush of speeding through a bunch finish to snatch the win at the last second. Or is that all just romantic bullshit? Sure, some bicycle races exist as a labour of love. At the grassroots level, volunteers put in thankless hours of work, administrative work, but also hard physical labour, erecting podiums, laying cables, setting up crowd barriers, purely to see the fruit of that labour manifest itself in a bike race simply existing for the sake of existing. But that's all at the lower end of the sport, which will always exist no matter what. As long as there are bikes, there will be those willing to race them. But we're talking at the higher end of the sport, the professionals. Why do professional bike races exist? We know why they used to exist, right? To sell newspapers. It was as simple as that. If you wanted to find out about a bike race, you had to buy a newspaper to read what happened. The newspapermen twigged this idea and used it as a way to hike in new customers and to increase sales. But who now buys a newspaper with the explicit intention of finding out what happened in a bike race? The internet has destroyed all that. You want to know what happens in a bike race? There'll be results and dozens of race reports at the click of a button before the winner has wiped the grime off of his forehead. We can see most bike races now too. We don't even need to read about them on the internet. We don't need to read about them at all. We can see for ourselves what happened. Missed it live? Doesn't matter. Sky Plus, YouTube, or any other number of sources have us covered. It's all there in moving Technicolor pictures. The transition of newsprint to television as the primary method of the consumption of cycling races is a subject tackled by Benjo Masso in his seminal book, The Sweat of the Gods. The advance of television naturally had far-reaching consequences for the print media. In the first half of the 20th century, bicycle road racing existed by the grace of the attention that newspapers were willing to give it. Riders needed journalists just as badly as the other way around. Usually they were very close to each other and shared each other's secrets. Beginning in the 1960s, the relationship became gradually more businesslike, to the degree that a few words spoken before the TV camera were more important to sponsors than a long article in a sports journal. This tendency continued. Bernard Tapie was a pioneer in this respect too, instructing his top riders in principle to give interviews only to television and glossy magazines such as Paris Match. Naturally, other cyclists also adopted this attitude as soon as they achieved star status. Thus, the Dane, Bjarne Riis, who had always been very approachable for journalists as long as he was just a minor rider, never had time anymore once he had won the Tour de France. It became all but impossible to elicit serious comments from him. Two cyclists best symbolised the arrival of an age in which the image had replaced the spoken and written word. The first was Mario Cipollini, the perfect showman, whose talents would have been largely wasted in the pre-television era. Like no other rider, he knew how to exploit the possibilities of the new medium, not only by his spectacular sprints, during which he usually glanced briefly over his shoulder at his defeated rivals, but also because he came up with some new gimmick in just about every race. These were rarely, if ever, striking comments. Instead, they were new touches to his appearance or clothing that were sometimes extraordinarily creative. None of the world champions who preceded him had ever hit on the idea of applying the rainbow colours emblematic of the world championship to his shorts or shoes. Cipollini's innovations were usually in complete conflict with the regulations, but knowing that he had once again gained valuable publicity, he happily paid the fines.
So a thorny issue we're getting ourselves potentially into, but before we deal with the overall theme of the piece, Masso mentions two riders who symbolised the arrival of TV. One was Cipollini, as mentioned, and the other was Miguel Indurain.
Yeah, for exactly the opposite reason. I mean, for the reasons Masso explains there, Cipollini used this new medium to his advantage and really enhanced his image. And for a completely different reason, Indurain was able to completely ignore the side of his job, really, to engage with the media and to try and build himself a profile and to promote his sponsor at the end of the day, because that's what they're paid to do. And that he decided that He didn't need to do that because he did all his talking on the road. And now all of a sudden you could see him doing it. Whereas before nobody could see you cycling. So you had to give the interviews, you had to push to promote yourself. And now with television, be it live or not, there's all this footage now of Indurain winning and doing the other part of his job that he was so good at. So he didn't feel the need to do the first part. So he for completely the opposite reason for Cipollini, that's how the arrival of TV shaped a guy like Indurain. And he's certainly not alone in that respect. You know, there's plenty of guys who shy away from the media for various reasons and you know, let their legs do the talking, the old cliche, but they can do that now, whereas they kind of couldn't before, you know. So that's kind of the distinction that Benjamin Marshall was drawing. But from the same source of the arrival of television was kind of changed the behavior of both types of riders, with Cipollini and Indurain being the two stereotypes of those two.
And you mentioned in the notes your own piece for, or one of the pieces you've written for Relur, and how it amazes you some riders just are so anti being interviewed by journalists. And I will say up front, I do have some sympathy with the riders in this regard. Getting a mic shoved under your nose after you've just raced over 200 kilometres and been asked the interminable "how were your legs today" question is enough to make anyone grumpy. But yeah, to your piece and Relur.
Yeah, I don't know whether you had a chance to look at that, but it's kind of a... Yeah, I wrote it a couple of years ago. It's a tongue-in-cheek thing. I kind of ripped it off, but it was about an American sport. It was probably American football, and it was written in the 1980s, and it was a really famous column written about the idea of a columnist being hassled for coverage by the players, and that all of the players really wanted this columnist to write about them. And the columnist would kind of sit in his ivory tower, not having to lift a finger, waiting for the masses to come to him and begging him to spend his week writing this precious column about the riders or about the NFL players. And it was a satirical piece designed to flip what he actually did on a weekly basis on its head, which was, you know, begging them to speak to him because he had nothing to work with. And yeah, basically ripped it off and applied it to cycling and just, you know, painted a picture of this sad rider wandering hotel lobbies after a race, trying to get a journalist to interview them, and all the journalists were too busy noshing into their post-race meals to pay attention to them, and pointing a finger at the fact that, you know, this is and should be a writer's job, is to cover to get themselves covered in media. And I know what you're saying about a mic shoved under their face after 200 kilometers. And I can only imagine how annoying that is. And quite often, you know, they don't even get asked a question. It's just a mic shoved under them. And, you know, they might just say their name and just be prompted to start speaking. You know, it's quite often they're not even asked a specific question. And, but that aside, the finish line, media aside, you know, even just getting an interview for a magazine, like, it's not long since I remember rumors, I think there were a little bit more than rumors, of Philippe Gilbert trying to charge journalists money to interview him. And I think
it was fairly well known, actually, never mind it being a rumor. As you say, it was certainly much more than that.
Yeah, and that's kind of what amazes me. You know, like, I know you always use the phrase that these guys are just rolling billboards, and that's true. And their job, what they're actually being paid to do by a sponsor, is to give that sponsor exposure in the media, be it TV or newspaper or whatever it might be. But in general, these guys are paid to give this sponsor exposure. And quite often, or, you know, most of the time, the best way to do that is to win a race. But it's not the only way to do it. You know, you can be the type of guy that is just interesting to talk to, who doesn't necessarily win races. And there's plenty of them. You know, they've made careers out of doing it. And a lot of them have written books at the end of their careers. The example that always comes to mind is Charlie Wagelius. He's very, very interesting guy to speak to. He's very eloquent in what he says, and he's very knowledgeable on the sport, but he never won a professional race. And he's written one of the best books about cycling by a rider that I've ever read. And, you know,
don't let David Miller hear you say that.
I haven't read his second one yet, so I don't know. I'll reserve judgment, but yeah, don't let David Miller hear you saying that. Yeah. But David Miller is another example. You know, love him or hate him, he can speak, and he does. And a lot of it isn't based on him winning races. You know, he's asked for his opinions on all kinds of things. And it is just this ability to engage with the media, which I can understand, you know, personalities are different. Not everybody has that ability or wants to speak about themselves. But again, just coming back to the idea that this is their job, and to kind of run away from journalists or make it really awkward for them, or arrange a meeting for 9 p.m. in a hotel lobby and you don't come down for 2 hours and you leave the journalist there waiting, you know, I would view that as kind of unprofessional and disrespectful. And, you know, these are just two guys doing a job. They're wildly different jobs, but they're both just doing a job at the end of the day. And it does amaze me when I hear stories, particularly like that of Philippe Gilbert trying to get money to be interviewed. You know, it should almost be the other way around. I was kind of satirizing that in the piece that I wrote, that it should be the other way around. It never will be, but, you know, it should be the riders that are pushing to be covered.
Sure. Getting to the real meat of the argument in your piece about, you know, why do bike races exist? Just to play devil's advocate, I guess, for a minute. You state that bike races existed in order to sell newspapers. I kind of get the feeling that's only partly true. I mean, specific bike races, of course, have been created with that goal in mind, but the bike race, I think, as a concept, must be a precondition, and a popular one too, before the sell more newspapers goal can be seen as a good idea. I.e., it's not like Henri de Grange invented bike racing, which he then persuaded readers of L'Auto to be interested in because of the coverage that he subsequently provided in the paper. So I think, yeah, it has been a very symbiotic relationship. But I think there's maybe a very good argument to be made for a distinction between why sport exists versus why professional sport exists.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, I know bike races will exist in and of themselves for no other reason than to stage a bike race. I think I am speaking specifically about professional races. And for instance, if you were to come along now and say, right, if you and me were to get together and say, right, let's make a professional race. Let's, for instance, create one in, I don't know, China, and say, okay, we want to get this off the ground. Why are they doing it? Like, I can only think of two reasons. And neither of them are the reasons that might have existed previously, which is selling newspapers. So the two reasons are to make money somehow, and I don't know how, or to promote a region, which I can understand. If a race is backed by the tourist board, for instance, I remember the Tour of Ireland, which was had a kind of a rebirth, a short-lived existence. 2009 was the last edition of that. It existed for a few years before that, and that was very much backed by the the Irish Tourist Board, who wanted to display the country and use it as a vehicle for advertising, for showing Ireland to the world or whatever it might be. And I know that's true of many races, but surely they're operating at a financial loss. The race itself, I know the idea is that you will, or somebody will recoup the losses through tourism. I think it's always very hard to measure that. I don't know how they measure that. You know, this kind of reciprocal benefit of having had a race in your region. But
well, the Tour of Yorkshire, for example, does publish figures on the so-called return on investment.
Yeah. You know,
the regional tourist board Visit Yorkshire, which is in partnership with the ASO to put that race on, do publish figures which say they make 10 times the amount that it's actually cost to put on. I think specifically with China, you were actually veering into political terms here, in that China's economy is booming. I think the regions in China are being persuaded that in order to sell a very, very outward-looking China, that sport is a good way of doing that. And you can criticise, praise China as a regime for doing so until the cows come home, I guess. And I don't really think that recouping that investment is something that the Chinese government, for example, are even looking to do. I think it's much more of a concern for races like the Tour of Yorkshire, or indeed, you know, races in Ireland, for example, where tourism is definitely the way by which it can be mentioned. China, I think, is somewhat of an anomaly, because I guess perhaps you could say the same of the Middle Eastern races of only a short time ago, where they had more money than sense. Yeah, put on a bike race. Doesn't matter if it's in the desert, you know, it'll make sense. Trust me. Mm. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, completely alien to the domestic sporting landscape, and it's at a time which the heartland of cycling in Europe isn't going to pay any attention to it. But put it on anyway. We've got more money than we know what to do with. So, yeah, I think that there are geopolitical reasons for why these new races seem to appear, when they simply do not make sense to the people that you would think would be interested in them, i.e. us as cycling fans.
Like, I mean, is it still true that of ASO's races? I mean, it's the Tour de France that makes the money, right? None of the other races actually make money. They're not profitable endeavours.
I'd need to consult Inna Ring's latest piece on that, as he's always the person to consult. But I think that's certainly the received wisdom on the subject, is that the Tour essentially finances everything else in ASO's portfolio.
Yeah, it still kind of baffles me as to, you know, why people. The elephant in the room here is the Hammer Series. Like, I mean, they put on a race this morning in Hong Kong, and I mean, I don't really, their interest is purely financial. They want to make money from this. They're not, as far as I know, they're not trying to promote any particular region. I don't think, as far as I know, again, they're not being financed by any particular region to buy the equivalent of a tourist board or whatever it might be, and that it is purely a money-making endeavour, so that they can spread the money amongst the teams, to make the teams more self-sufficient.
Of course, because that series is owned by the Velon teams, subtitling what you've said there.
Yeah, and so this is a financial endeavour, this Hammer Series, but I just, who's giving them money? Like, where is the money coming from? I still don't understand. I mean, is it TV rights? I think it is. This is the big invisible cash cow. I'm always reminded of this There's a great scene in a South Park episode where there's the underpants gnomes. Did you ever see this one? Where the underpants gnomes have this great plan to make money, and they have this their plan is put up on a big board. And step one, collect all the underpants. Step two, question mark. Step three, money. and it's, I think, you know, it's a satirical take on exactly the type of thing. You know, there's a kind of a good idea that you think might make money, and you just do it, and you're not really sure how it's going to do it, but you do it anyway, and at the end of it you expect to make money, but there's this massive gap in the middle, and I just don't see it. I don't know, maybe I'm being completely naive, or I haven't really thought this through, but I don't really see it, and I can't really see them making, I mean, maybe they can end up being profitable somehow, but not in any significant way, I don't think. I don't know. Am I?
Well, I mean, I've been Googling while you were talking, yeah, there, and the Hammer series specifically in Hong Kong, which you mentioned, appears to be sponsored by Sung Hung Kai Properties. So I presume that they'd be providing money in order to, you know, essentially like the teams themselves are paid by heating and flooring and grouting, yeah, manufacturers, whatever they happen to be. The race itself is sponsored by certain commercial partners. And it's the same with all other races. You know, for example, Cofidis, well, they also have the team. They're a major sponsor of the Vuelta. And a number of sponsors will be sought to you know, convert that the eyeballs which fall upon the race, both on the ground and the media opportunities, into a marketing opportunity for the guys or the companies providing money. The one aspect, you know, in that big question mark, I think, in the South Park episode, which the Hammer series I don't think I've ever considered, is anybody A, interested in what they're doing, and B, can actually understand what they're doing? Because you've said quite rightly, you know, that they are in business to make money for the Velon teams, but nobody is interested, it would appear, in the format that they've managed to concoct, because they have to focus, you know, the immutable object for Velon is not the rider, it's the team. And as, you know, you've put in your notes, you know, nobody was going to care about or be motivated to emulate a laminate flooring company by who wins the Hammer series, whereas they will be in the tales of Merckx winning the Tour, or Eno winning Liège in the snow back in 1980. And I think the takeaway of that is that the Velon teams, again, aren't considering the question mark of, you know, how do you, if they're making money via commercial sponsors coming to the races that they're inventing, unfortunately the eyeballs need to follow that. Otherwise those commercial sponsors are not going to see the kind of return on investment that they're looking for.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, I've was thinking about this quite a bit over the past week, and, you know, I've been quite dismissive of the Hammer series on this show and on Twitter in general, and I don't want to be, you know, I see
what you're saying, yeah. You know, you don't want to be criticizing just for the sake of it,
yeah,
but by the same token, it's kind of, look guys, you need to be giving us something that we can get behind, so yeah, that we can support you, yeah,
like I can't get excited about it, like exactly what you just said there, you know, there's nobody is going to, well, I say that, I could be proven wrong, but I don't think anybody's going to be writing a book about Mitchelton Scott in 10 years time and you know, going through why they were so legendary and why they were so interesting the way they would with, you know, a rider. And people get interested in riders and characters and their stories, and that's you know, this is what this whole show is about, is, you know, regaling crazy stories about Jacques Anquetil and Fausto Coppi and you know, all of these characters, whereas the teams, just by their nature, are transient. They're gone, nobody cares about them anymore. I mean, who did Jacques Anquetil ride for when he won the Tour de France? Nobody remembers really or cares. Or, you know, the same goes for Eddie Merckx. All you really care about is Eddie Merckx. And, you know, you might care about his teammates and who his director sportif was, but the team itself, it's gone now. So nobody cares about it. And at the end of the day, that's cycling's appeal is the individual. And I know the Hammer series are trying to change that and in order to create value for the teams. And I think it's an admirable thing they're trying to do. And again, I do find myself being quite flippant about them on Twitter a lot of the times just because these jokes keep coming to me. But I appreciate what they're doing. But like you said, I just don't think they haven't happened upon a format which has gripped anybody, I don't think. I mean, even today, Quickstep won the race and then they actually changed the identity of who won the race because of some weird lap puncture rule. So that was kind of a bit of a farce. And they were trying to create this identity of a race which was the same, you know, over and over, no matter where it was. And yet in this Hong Kong Hammer 2, they didn't have the Hammer Climb. It wasn't the same as the two previous ones they had and the ones they had last year. So, and I just think they've gotten a lot wrong and they haven't really done anything to correct them yet. And I hope they do. And I wish them the best and anything that kind of keeps teams afloat, you know, kind of by its nature has to be good for the sport, but it's hard to see how they're going to get there. That big question mark between the underpants gnomes and the big pile of money. I can't see it.
Just to finish this off, there's been some interesting stuff that we've all noticed, certainly you and I have, of riders doing something for themselves through social media. And the No-Go Tour that I think captured everybody's imagination just in the past month or so.
Again, yeah, like, so that's, you know, that was two riders. Okay, they were put in this position through no fault of their own. They found themselves without a team. This was Larry Warbass and Connor Dunn of the Aqua Blue Sport team, which imploded and they were left without a team. And they decided to do this, as an attempt to keep themselves relevant to try and find a team for the following year because they'd no more races that they could take part in. So they had to try and come up with something. And I think it was really admirable what they did. And they did keep themselves in the news, very much so. And I know Larry Warbass ended up getting signed. Is he signed by AG2R for next year?
I think he is, yeah. And I don't know about Connor yet, though.
Yeah, I don't think Connor Dunn's quite found himself a team yet. But, you know, they did this as a way to create exposure. Now, in this instance, it was for themselves rather than for their sponsor. But there's two guys about to do it now. I don't know whether you've seen Thomas De Gendt and Tim Wellens are about they're about to go off and do the same thing after they took part in the Hammer Hong Kong. And, you know, as far as I know, that's not to get a contract for next year. That's just, I don't know why they're doing it, but you can guarantee that they'll get loads of exposure online for doing this. And I saw Peter Costins, whose book we mentioned in the last piece, he tweeted this morning that, you know, he reckons it would be a toss-up about who gets more exposure next week. These two guys cycling around, not taking part in a race, just cycling around for the love of it, or the Tour of Guangxi, which we're supposed to take seriously.
And especially in the era we're in now, as you mentioned, with social media, but also specifically YouTube. It's a really interesting one because the idea of removing the competition completely from it so that the interesting point is the exploit rather than a race per se. And that's the thing that people hook on to is interesting because I'm reminded of not only what the guys did on the No-Go Tour, but at a much smaller level. I don't know if you follow on YouTube, there's a guy called Francis Cade who used to do a bit of domestic racing but has given it up. And now his job is to just film stuff on the bike, and he's done things like interviewing Alex Dowsett, for example, while both on the bike. He's done immense things like riding through Death Valley with his two mates in the middle of summer, which is fascinating because it's so bloody stupid. But he's an engaging character, as are James and Lawrence, who were the two guys who went with them. And you found yourself, like in the No-Go Tour, being drawn into their personalities and their story. And that's the way that YouTube works for a lot of people. Mm. And of course, they get paid through, you know, advertising that they have on their channel, as well as marketing opportunities. And I'm wondering, just based on what you kind of said, linking this to the No-Go Tour, whether there is actually now an opportunity for some riders to be as famous for their YouTube on social media presence, for their exploits on a bike, as is possible just by being a rider in the World Tour.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, it's not just cycling, I think, that these opportunities present themselves. Like, I remember there was a guy who was particularly famous for just doing keepy uppies with a football.
Yeah. You know?
And he used to get paid by sponsors. I can't remember who the sponsor was, but it was somebody big. It might have even been Nike, to go and do keepy uppies in front of monuments all around the world, you know, famous places. And he would get paid, or it might have been GoPro, get paid to do these things. Yeah, it's an interesting avenue to go down. And I do wonder whether more and more riders will.
I know that Alex Dowsett is really into trying to kind of work on his channel, and because he enjoys making the videos. So I think it might actually be a way forward. But before we disappear any further down this rabbit hole, I think we probably should wrap things up for this show. Mm. As ever, where can people find you on the interwebs, Killian?
I'm still at Irish Peloton on Twitter, and my email is still mail@irishpeloton.com.
Well, thank you for joining us for another edition of the show as we discussed Il Lombardia and, curiously, why bike races exist. The only pertinent fact actually being that if they didn't, we'd all be out of a job. And given that we do have a job to do, please join us again soon for more historical hyperbole in the next edition of This Week in Cycling History.